Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is mystery writer Elizabeth Craig. Elizabeth, good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's nice to have you on the show. I've been following your adventures on Twitter for a long, long time. And being a writer myself, it's always fun to have another writer on the show, especially a mystery novelist. It's so cool.
Mystery's the best. Yeah, mystery's the best.
So thank you for joining me. You are the author of the best-selling mystery books that includes The Southern Quilting Mysteries, The Memphis Barbecue Mysteries, and Myrtle Clover Cozy Mysteries for Penguin Random and Midnight Inc. You also counsel other writers on the craft of writing in your blog. Very cool. I'm always fascinated by writers, as I said, authors, journalists, because there really isn't a how-to guide on how to do that. What started it all for you?
You know, I think it's just, it's story. I think that's what starts it off for most writers, just the love of great stories and reading. And I mean, unfortunately, I had absolutely no formal training. So it was learning on the job. There weren't any creative writing classes. I actually spoke to a creative writing class about a month ago, and I was telling the kids at the high school that I would have killed for a class like that when I was in high school or in college. I mean, in college, I was an English major, but there wasn't a creative writing course that I took. So for me, it was just growing up reading Nancy Drew and Trixie Belden and watching Scooby-Doo on TV. And just it, I think mystery is especially good at hooking kids. I think they've done an excellent job at hooking kids into the genre. And it took off for me that way.
Did you start off writing mystery novels focused on kids specifically and then transition later? How did that go?
I actually have never written for children before, although that would be a great idea. It makes the most sense, honestly, to have written something for kids because that's where I found my original inspiration. But I think after I graduated from those books, it was the Agatha Christie's because my library in Anderson, South Carolina, where I grew up, they had run out of things for me to read. And so my mother just reluctantly, she was like, well, I guess you can go to the adult section. And she was like, maybe Agatha Christie.
I know that feeling. The bookmobile used to come around my neighborhood, and I'd go, I read that one.
And then what do you do? I mean, my mother's friends were digging around in their attics looking for things for me to read. You know, they found Cherry Ames and Boxcar Kids and stuff like that. But I was reading Agatha Christie, and I dabbled a little bit into MacDonald and Parker, but I think my mother, she wasn't as happy about me reading.
Oh, are you a John D. MacDonald fan?
Oh, you know, I was. Oh. I'm a little hard. Well, it's funny thing
my heart is beating. Be still, my beating heart. John D. MacDonald is the best.
Yes. I mean, just awesome books, but maybe a little hard-boiled if you're 11 or 12. I'm not really sure. I don't think my mother was very happy about it. But
He's best known for his Travis McGee series, but he's written some other science fiction that actually been made into movies, like The Girl, The Gold Watch and everything.
Right.
And some other, you know, Florida Life and Times Beach novels and stuff. But I guess he's written maybe 50 or 60 books, but he's most known for the Travis McGee series, which has been, a couple of them have been made into movies too.
Yeah, I think it was mostly Travis McGee that we had at the library. It was a pretty small branch. It's a big place now, but at the time in the 1970s and early 80s, it wasn't such a big place. So I just kind of, I was reading all kinds of, mostly mysteries. That was my favorite thing to read.
So then you made a transition from reading to writing. You started with short stories. Tell me about that.
Well, I wrote a lot of, I mean, just as a kid, especially tons and tons of short stories. And just that was the thing that I loved the most.
Just for yourself? Not for,
just for myself. And my best friend was also a writer. She's an artist and I'm a writer. So it's kind of funny because that's what we said we were going to be when we grew up. And our parents were like, what? You know, artists and writers usually make it too well. But we would just sit for hours with each other and writing stories. So we weren't actually talking to each other, but we were writing. And I just loved it. And I had a fourth grade teacher that was very encouraging. And I did all the usual kid stuff where, you know, I joined the newspaper and the literary magazine and all of that. And then I guess it kind of came to a head when I studied abroad in London when I was in college. And I interned for a magazine there, one of those magazines that they give you for free on the tube. And it was 9 to 5, and they had me writing stories for that. And I thought, okay, well, this is something I can do for a living, maybe journalism, you know, advertising, something like that.
How were you writing these stories, on a computer?
No, this was before. So this was just typing most of the time, or by hand, if, you know, when I was a kid. And then for the for 9 to 5, I think they had a computer then. Of course, it wasn't hooked up to the internet because there wasn't. Well, there was an internet, but we weren't on it. But at that time, I think it was a little bit of word processing going on then. And of course, we were still doing cutout layouts and that kind of thing where you paste it on a board. I mean, this sounds just the middle of the Middle Ages or something.
Oh, yeah. But I had a magazine in the 80s called Peelings, and I remember the wax boards and using an Apple II and printing out text on an image writer and then cutting with scissors and pasting onto wax boards.
Yeah. It's a weird hybrid, isn't it?
I mean, strange.
Got the computer aspect going on, but then you've still got cutting and pasting. You know, there seems to be something kind of wrong with that, but it was cool. It was a lot of fun. And so I thought, well, maybe I can do this journalism thing for a while. And I found that didn't really go so well for me, because the temptation for me was always to go, you know, this interview would be a whole lot better if this person had actually said this instead of this, you know. So I was always plagued by this just temptation to make something completely up. And I thought that I'm not going to make it as a journalist. I really just want to make things up all day long.
Did you correct me if I'm wrong? Did you spend some time writing for a newspaper as a journalist?
I wrote for a magazine, a literary arts magazine in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh,
and
that's right.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was interesting to a certain degree. I loved hanging out with artists, and I loved going to galleries and doing things like that. But I was doing like sometimes interior design stories or just interviewing different types of artists. And it was interesting to hear from them. But at the same time, I wanted to be doing something a little bit more creative myself.
Was that on assignment where your editor would tell you what to do and you had to sort of tough it out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just did whatever they told me to do because it was a very small operation. So sometimes they told me I needed to model clothes for a photo shoot. And I'd be like, all right, you know, whatever they needed. I would sell ads. I would do interviews. I'd write stories. Whatever it was they needed that day, that's what I did.
Well, you told me that was sort of frustrating and that you really wanted to be more creative. But did that lay any foundation in your mind for the craft of writing later, or was it just a waste?
I don't think it was waste, but I've never thought about it that way. It's interesting because I had just read this book, and Neil Gaiman had an essay in it talking about influence and inspiration, and he talked about inspiration and influence being like a compost heap where you throw all these scraps on it, and then later you've got this wonderful thing growing out of it, but maybe you just never really knew you couldn't tell what the original scraps even were. You know, it had morphed into this other thing. And I think that's true. I mean, I think that there's lots of bits and pieces that we don't even realize we're getting influenced by. Strange things, you know. I mean, I remember, you know, just Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood being a big influence on me, but Mr. McFeely Always Rushing and The White Rabbit for Alice in Wonderland, mm-hmm. and all these just really strange, whatever stood out to me, I think that helped me. And obviously, anytime I wrote and, you know, made sense, obviously I was helping to learn the craft and become a better writer.
Were you thinking about that in college when you were an English major? Or were you just sort of, you know, thinking, well, English is cool, I'll do that instead of nuclear physics?
Yeah, I don't think nuclear physics was on the table for me.
Well, I mean, you know, was taking English in college part of a career plan?
Yes.
Or was okay?
Yeah. I'm a one trick pony, and that is really the trick, and it's an awesome trick, but it's all I can really do, and that's it. So I was looking really at journalism, advertising. I just didn't think I could make a living off of books. I wanted to think that, but I was trying to be realistic and practical. And so I was trying to go the direction that I thought most writers who were making money were going in.
Did you try to engage other authors or go to author parties or things like that and try to schmooze with the writing crowd or workshops or anything like that?
I really didn't. And I've always been very much an introvert. I did try some writing kind of critique group type stuff later on. But to me, it was sort of like playing tennis. You know, you have a tennis partner who you're either awesome and they're terrible, or they're awesome and you're terrible. And it's hard to get a good match for feedback with that in person. So I was glad in the late 90s when finally we were starting to get some semblance of order on the internet. And there were some online, it was more like forums, I guess, back then, or maybe even news groups. But there were some writers on there. And to me, that was perfect because I didn't have to actually really interact with them in person, but I could interact with them online and kind of ideas.
Yeah. That was one of the questions I had on my list, was the advent of social media changing how you think and work as a writer. Certainly with Twitter and blogs, you have a much better chance of engaging your audience and getting feedback from readers and fans.
That's true. You can really connect with readers, where before, I mean, I remember as a child, I had a book that told me where to write to get people's autographs, and that was a big deal. And so I even wrote Dr. Seuss and got Dr. Seuss's autograph. But it was quite a process. I mean, it was like the author wasn't really engaged with the readers. They were in their own separate place, and you had to go maybe through their agent or their publisher to get to them. And now, I mean, you know, my email address is out there on the internet. Anybody who wants to send me an email or contact me on Twitter or Facebook, you know, it's right there, and we can talk in real time.
Do you ever get readers or Twitter followers who say, you know, I really wish you had done something different in that book?
Oh, yeah.
Well, here's an idea for another one.
They do. They do. In fact, I've taken some reader ideas that have readers who have contacted me on Facebook and you know, said, oh, wouldn't it be cool if Myrtle did this? Mm-hmm. And I thought, that really would be cool. I'll maybe do a spin on that. And yeah, they do definitely tell me there's room for improvement. And if I'm lucky, they'll tell me in an email or on Twitter. If I'm unlucky, they'll put it in a reader review on Amazon. And then it's there. But I do. I read all of my reviews, and I especially appreciate negative feedback because it's the only way I can really grow as a writer. Sure. Although there's a danger to it as well. I had read some reader comments that they thought my sleuth is an octogenarian and her son kind of gets in her business a little bit. And there was one book where I think readers thought that Red was kind of going over the line a little bit, and they were really fussing about him. And so the next book, I broke his leg. And I was like, okay, he's out of action now. And then in the reviews for that book, they were like, but we really miss Red.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Myrtle Clover. She was your first sleuth, right?
Yes. Yes, she was.
So as a young mother with a small child in kindergarten, you were writing about an octogenarian detective. How did that come to be? I mean, normally you think of Tom Selleck, you know?
you know, I've always felt, I don't know, I think I'm an old soul in a lot of ways. And when I was growing up, my favorite show was Murder, She Wrote. I was like the only teenager probably watching Murder, She Wrote anywhere.
Oh, and what was the name of that actress? I keep forgetting her name.
Oh, Jessica Fletcher. It was Angela Lansbury.
Ah, right. Right.
Awesome. Yeah, she's awesome. But I watched that, and, you know, I was a huge Masterpiece Mystery fan, so I was on PBS every Sunday night to see what they were playing.
And, me too. Well, and what do you think of the modern BBC mysteries, like Grantchester and Midsummer Mysteries and Shetland and Father Brown?
Oh, yeah, they're fantastic. Midsummer is interesting because they have so many creative ways for people to die. It's amazing that anybody is alive in those in that area.
What tickles me is that this little tiny village like Father Brown, you know, population 317, and there's a murder every week. It's a dangerous place.
It's the most dangerous place on Earth. And the body count in some of those shows is really high, too.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing stuff. Well, I'm looking at the clock here, and I'm thinking that it's about time we did an ad. We're going to have to break away and pay for the show. So
that sounds good.
We'll be back in a second. Folks, stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with mystery writer Elizabeth Craig. So in the second half, I wanted to ask you about some of the life and times and mechanics of writing novels. So is it still possible to make a living writing paper novels published by a publisher that goes into Barnes & Noble, or have you found that you've had to transition a bit to the digital age?
I think it's possible, but it's tricky. It's hard to get in. It's harder to get in now as a mid-list author. They've really kind of cut down. They're looking for their blockbusters, and they're kind of putting their time and energies into those, understandably. Also, I think, most of the people that I know of different age ranges, when they want to buy a book, they're actually going to Amazon to purchase it, even if it's a print book. They're just going online, and there's a pretty significant discount most of the time, and then they'll just have it arrive at their door. So I think it is important to make that transition now, and that's definitely what I've done. I was traditionally published. I had 9 books published by trade publishers, and now I have the rest of them. I guess there's another 10, 15 that I've put out independently, and I like the reach that I get as a self-published author, because I can get my books in audio, I can have them translated, I can have them in bookstores all over the world, where it was my publisher, Penguin Random House, wasn't quite as fleet and agile in terms of being able to do that.
What about payments? Were you making more money with the paper novels compared to the digital age now, where you have a broader reach, or is it sort of evened out?
I think originally, there probably was more income generated by print novels originally. But of course, my cut of that was much smaller. So 15% of net in terms of some of the deals I had, very small. So really, for me personally, I was able to make more off of digital sales, especially compounding that with international sales and audio and just the other different types of formats. I've got hardcover there, some library edition type stuff, and that all of it together as a group, I make more money that way.
Do those older novels still provide an income, or does it sort of dissipate over time as the book gets older?
I think it could, but right now for the Memphis Barbecue series, that series is discontinued. And so, yes, the sales from those books have dwindled, although not completely stopped, which is interesting. And I think it's because my readers are still going, oh, she has another series, and picking it up. But for the other two series, because I've continued them myself, then readers go back and start at the beginning. So the sales have actually been pretty strong for me because those series are ongoing. I'm into like book number 12 of one of them, and I guess book maybe number 8 or 9 of the other.
Those publishers pay much, much in arrears, right? I mean, it's like pay every 90 days and then a couple of quarters in arrears, whereas in Amazon, you get your money fairly quickly. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I would be paid. Of course, I got an advance, but the advance was, it was not anything to set the world on fire, honestly. And then you had many months where you just didn't receive anything at all from the publisher. and the accounting was really bad. My agent would get the kind of the statements and things, and she would forward it along, and it was just like, you're looking at it going, what on earth? I mean, I was obviously, I was an English yeah. major. I was not a business major. I'm going, what is this? I don't even understand, you know? So now they've really come a long way, and Penguin will email me a statement. They haven't come a long way with the payments, but they've come a long way with the statements. The statements are better.
So you told me the other day that you are a PC user because of your husband being an employee of a PC-related company.
Yes.
So it's always fun to hear about people who use Macs because there's some cool Mac programs for novelists, Scrivener and Odyssey. But I think Scrivener is on the PC too. I'm not sure.
It is. Yes, it is.
Do you use it?
I use it in a very strange way. I think I'm probably the worst person to talk about this. I do have Scrivener, and I use it as a repository for my story Bibles, which is, for me, that it helps me keep my characters straight.
Mm-hmm.
Who did what when, what they look like, what street they live on, if they used to be.
It was designed for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's got a lot of use for that. And you can, obviously you can save, articles you find online, or I may have like a picture gallery of what my characters look like. And that's a cool place to keep it. I did try to use it, but I found that I'm very much a linear writer. I just write straight through, and I write on Word, and I don't even stop for chapter breaks. I just go straight through the book, and then I go back later and put the chapter breaks and things in. So I think trying to change my process didn't really work for me, but it's a great place for me to keep research and other things.
I can understand, because everybody I've talked to says that these traditional publishers require the manuscripts to be submitted in Microsoft Word.
Yes, that's exactly right. And they use track changes, and you have to do it that way. It is just they do not change very, very well over there at the publishers, and they have a particular way of doing things.
I read one book. I, from time to time, I've been an aspiring novelist myself, but I just haven't had the time. As a technical writer, I know some people have made that transition. Brian Chaffin has written a science fiction novel. He's our executive vice president. I think Dan Morin has written a science fiction novel. It's something we all aspire to, whether we family and work allows it or not. It is a big question, but is it true that your first novel is really sort of an elaborate business card? I read that once. Just to prove you can stitch 100,000 words together?
That is an interesting way of looking at it. I think in some ways it is, but it's even more so to prove to yourself you can do it, maybe, to get the confidence. you can do it. You know, you show yourself, I can complete it, because when you get to the middle of your book, you're like, what am I doing? Oh my gosh. You know, and you get the saggy middle syndrome and you start wondering. But I think you get to prove it to yourself and everybody else that is something that you can do.
I think you also get some bad impulses out of your system in print, so you can digest and analyze your own writing weaknesses, and you go back and you look at it and you go, well, I got that out of my system. Now I can write a real good novel.
Yeah. I don't go back and read those books. I really don't. I don't ever go back and read. I mean, I'll say never, but I mean, sometimes a book club will contact me and ask me to speak about a book that I had, you know, I wrote it a long time ago. Maybe I wrote it in, 2010, and I'll have to reread it, but it's hard. It's really painful to reread earlier stuff. And I don't completely know why that is, but at least I find it so. I mean, I don't feel like my writing is bad. I think there's some things that I've changed, but it's just awkward for some reason.
Yeah, I know. I've seen movie stars talk about how they never watch their own movies. They can't stand to see themselves after the fact. And they just say, I've never seen that movie. I act, I get paid, but I can't stand to watch it, so I don't.
That's
crazy.
So funny. Yeah, I think I remember, what is the show, Downton Abbey, and the old lady who's in it. I cannot remember her name. Is it Maggie or
Maggie
something?
Smith?
Yes. And she was saying she had never seen a single episode, which just completely confounded me.
She stole that series. She was good.
So good in that show. I love that show. And she was the best part of it. But I just thought it was so funny that she had never seen a single episode.
Yeah, funny. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you was, does the life cycle of a novel and the current economics and lifestyle, I know you mentioned that people go back and pick up your older books, but do you find yourself stressed to go at a certain pace and crank out a novel at a certain time interval so that you can maintain an even flow? Or do you have the liberty to, you know, take a few months off and relax? And how stressful is mystery writing?
It's, you know, I don't think it's very stressful, but the pace of it can be, as you've alluded to. And I was doing about 3.5 books a year, which is it's a pretty tough schedule for me as, you know, a mom. I've got other things going on as well at the same time. But I think the last year I thought, I feel a little burned out. There was a point where I thought, okay, I think I need to just take some time. I'm going to just take a little time off, and I'm just going to try to kind of soak in a lot of things creatively. There was an Andrew Wyeth show that had come through town. I went to see that with my husband and watched some shows on creative people being creative and biographies. I read some biographies, but I couldn't stay away from it. I mean, I had told myself I didn't have to write, and I went back to the book. So I don't think I can stop. I have slowed down some, but I think I miss it when I stop. If I'm trying to take a rest, then I miss doing it. So I have to pick it back up.
Do you have a personal schedule and a special place to write? Like some people do, get up, take a shower, get dressed, 10 o'clock, hit the computer, write until lunch or something like that.
Yeah, very much like that. I'm a routine driven person. I think a lot of writers are, and I get up and I do usually write around 5 o'clock in the morning. And usually that's awesome. That's usually a wonderful time.
That explains it. I got an email from you at 3 a.m. Now I understand.
Yes, I am. Also, I don't sleep a lot, so I'm an insomniac who gets up very early in the morning.
Wow.
But, you know, you get a lot done in the morning because usually there's nothing going on. I mean, sometimes, you know, pets cause drama early in the morning, but ordinarily there's nothing going on. Nobody else is up, especially if you're on the East Coast. You know, you've just got this beautiful, quiet atmosphere. It's perfect.
So for the listeners, tell me about your current projects and your current characters and the current book. Sort of give us like thumbnail sketch of what's happening right now in with your novels. And the series that you're writing and so on.
Sure. I write the Myrtle Clover Mysteries, and that is my octogenarian sleuth. And I put out Cooking is Murder earlier this year. Myrtle's just a terrible cook, and she thinks she's an awesome cook. And so hilarity follows, as you can imagine. And I'm currently writing a book, a Myrtle book called The Body in the Trunk. So there's a body in the trunk of a car, and it's just fun. I have such a good time writing that series. I just love the characters. And I've got another series, which is the Southern Quilting Mysteries, and that originated with Penguin Books. And I have put out Pressed for Time. And that book came out, gosh, I think it must be 6 weeks ago now, something like that. And that series I'm continuing on, having a lot of fun writing that one as well. I am not a quilter, but I do a lot of research into quilting. So theoretically, I could actually make a quilt myself. But I think it's just incredibly hard work, and I'm not coordinated enough to do it. Really respect the people who can. And then I write the Memphis Barbecue Mysteries, but that series has been discontinued, unfortunately, by Penguin. And it has revolves around a barbecue restaurant in Memphis, Tennessee, and a lot of crimes occur around there. So maybe not the safest place to eat.
Ah, I was just going to make that joke, but you made it ahead of me.
Sorry.
Excellent. Nice. So you've been doing this for a while now.
Yeah.
What's the most satisfying thing about being a mystery novelist? Is it the fact that you get to call your own shots and make up your own characters, or is it more professional oriented, like, you know, being part of the John D. McDonald, Robert Parker, you know, genre and being in that group? What's the most satisfying thing about what you do?
I think for me, it's because mysteries, you create this really interactive process for the reader. And I don't know if you're this way, but I feel like I am solving the case along with the sleuth. It's just there's nothing else like it to me, because if you've done a good job as a mystery writer, you have given this, you're giving the readers exactly what the sleuth gets in terms of clues and red herrings. And it's just that opportunity to safely solve a murder mystery in your armchair and to provide that for readers and just make this big mess in this world and then tidy it all up in the end. And I think it's very satisfying.
Do you write a synopsis for yourself of every future event that you know is going to happen until the end of the novel, and then go back and look at it in ignorance from the perspective of the detective, knowing only what they know at the time, so that as a writer, you know how to flesh out the state of, so to speak, the state of ignorance of the writer and illuminate the detective and illuminate him as you go along? Or do you sort of make up stuff as you go?
I think I've gotten so much into the pattern of it that right now I make it up as I go, and I know who knows what when. But at the time when I first started out, I made sure that I knew what everybody knew and what they didn't know, because it can get complicated.
Do you write in the first person? I haven't seen your books, I'm sorry, but...
Oh, no, you know, I write in third.
Third person. The omniscient viewpoint.
Yes, I do. And it's just easier for me for some reason. I don't know. That comes more naturally to me. I think more of first person is maybe more of the hard-boiled genre. Maybe thriller. I think thriller does it really well. Maybe not so much the traditional mysteries. I think that's harder.
I'm a big fan of Robert B. Parker. He's not with us anymore, and I've read all of his Jesse Stone and Sonny Randall books. They're fantastic. One of the things I like about Robert Parker, and I always thought if I ever wrote a novel, I would mimic him exactly. He keeps his chapters very short, one and a half to 2 pages. And the net psychological result is that it's a page turner. You get to the end of the short chapter, and it's very easy to just move on to the next one, and your appetite keeps on going. Whereas I've read some other science fiction books by authors I won't name, where they have 40-page chapters, and you yawn and go, when do we reach an end point here? When can I, reach a logical conclusion and get ready for the next chapter? Put the book down and go to sleep. Do you find that the physical appearance and the chapter length and the way the book is laid out affects how the reader approaches the novel? And tell me about that.
Yeah, I think it's very important for pacing. And I was I liked Spencer for Hire. I even watched, that was an 80s show, right? Was it 80s? It was 80s, wasn't it?
Robert Urich, right.
Yeah, exactly. Gosh. That's right. I think it does help. And I think another person who uses that to his advantage is James Patterson. Obviously, he has very short chapters. My first couple of books, the chapters were a bit longer, and I actually got feedback in the reviews about it. So now my chapters are more like 8 or 9 pages long. But it's still that same. You're right. It's a good pacing effect because I have lots of scene breaks in there, too. So you do have stopping points because, gosh, in my life right now, I mean, I'm picking up a book and putting it down and picking it up and putting it down. I don't have hours to spend, unfortunately, to read. It's just very intermittent. And I think it helps to have short chapters.
Who are you reading these days as inspiration, besides Patterson, perhaps?
Yeah, I read a little bit of his, although he farms out his reading so much anymore. I just don't know who I'm reading anymore. I do like reading going back and reading some of the older books. I loved Colin Dexter's Inspector Morse was one of my favorites. I just love the crossword puzzle, opera-loving kind of stuff. Elizabeth George, her Inspector Linley books are very good. Deborah Crombie, she writes a Duncan Kincaid and Gemma James. Books, and it's kind of fun to see a partnership there. And right now I'm reading a Louise Penny book called Glass Houses that's very good. Just kind of gotten started on that, but I'm a fan of her series. And I read a lot of other stuff too. I like to read nonfiction a good deal. I read On Immunity in Inoculation recently, and it was very interesting to see sort of a history of immunization and what people thought of it. And a medically oriented book called Being Mortal, which was very interesting. So I try to kind of spice it up, although mystery is my first love, and I keep going back to it.
I want to close. We're running out of time here. I want to close with a jackpot question. Do you know if James Patterson was the ghostwriter behind Richard Castle? Because there was this running joke with ABC, and Richard Castle had these novels that had Nathan Fillion's picture on the back, as if Nathan Fillion, as Richard Castle, was actually writing them. But nobody knows who really wrote them. Do you?
I don't, but that is a fascinating thing to think about. That might have to be inspiration for another book.
Yeah, that was very cool.
I like that.
Did I miss anything? We're coming to a close here. Is there anything you want to add or inspiration for the listeners?
I mean, if you're a writer, just set the bar really low. And I know that sounds bad, but just, you know, try to set the goal so low that you can make it just by accident. Even if it's just, I'm going to open up my laptop and I'm going to pull up my word processing program and that's it. Just set it low. And that way you have a string of successes every day and you can build on that.
Cool. Well, I want to thank you for telling me your story and all this inspiration about your life and your success as a mystery writer. And we had a lot of fun. So thanks for joining me. It was great.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
Folks, I'm glad you came by. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you next week.